Good morning, everyone. The next case on the court's calendar is Lisa Williams et al. Versus 8th Judicial District Court and Claim Jumper Acquisition Company, LLC, Real Party in Interest, case number 66629. Ready to proceed, counsel? Hi, Mr. Schrager.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the court, and good morning. My name is Bradley Schrager of Wolf Rifkin, and I'm here on behalf of the petitioners. I would like to beg the court's indulgence for 3 minutes of rebuttal time at the close of my argument. Your Honors, there's one concept in this matter that, if accepted by the court, I think more or less directs the analysis and most likely the result itself. And that is that plaintiffs made their claims under the Minimum Wage Amendment. They could not, in fact, have made their claims under any other legal provision. In 2006, the Minimum Wage Amendment, enacted by the people, established an unusual two-tier system for the minimum wage. Currently, employers can pay the base wage, which is $8.25 an hour, or if an employer provides qualifying health insurance to an employee and all his or her dependents at a capped cost of 10% of that employee's wages from the employer, the employer can pay down to $7.25. Below, plaintiffs are not saying or not claiming a mere minimum wage deficiency. They're not saying the minimum wage was $7.25 and Claim Jumper paid them $5. That's a simple math problem. What plaintiffs are claiming is that Claim Jumper determined to pay them less than $8.25, in fact, all the way down to $7.25, and didn't qualify to do so. That the health insurance that they offered, not even provided, that they offered, didn't qualify, and that it cost too much. That claim did not even exist before 2006. It was impossible, and it's certainly nowhere in any of the statutory aspects of the labor code. The minimum wage amendment in this regard is sui generis. It stands alone. Now, if you accept that notion, it is unnecessary to engage in a borrowing of an analogous statute of limitation from somewhere else. It is unnecessary to determine from whence plaintiff's claim arose. Stated that way, claims under the Minimum Wage Amendment, and especially plaintiff's claims in this matter, arose under its own terms and its own provisions.
But where do you find that expressly negated the provisions of 608-260? And wouldn't it have to be, wouldn't you have to assume that, and it would have to be implied?
I don't think at this point implied repeal is the best way to determine this case.
I kind of agree with you.
Yeah. Simply by looking at the minimum wage amendment itself and realizing that its claims are separate and apart from any claim you could make under 250 or 260 by way of 250, that really puts paid to this notion that these claims arose anywhere other than under the minimum wage amendment itself. Now, I can get into it and implied repeal analysis because we made that argument below. And that was in the first flush after Thomas. It seemed a very promising argument. Lawyers take time and they develop their arguments over the ensuing year. I now think that's not probably the best way to describe the effect of the minimum wage amendment on 250 and 260, 608, 250, and 260. Because since then, we've also seen that plaintiffs continue to make claims under 250 and 260. In fact, in the Sapphire case from last year, the court noted that those claims for minimum wage were not made under the amendment. They were made under 250. I'm not entirely sure why somebody would make those claims. I don't think they're necessary now, but some people may have their reasons. What is certainly true, if not impliedly repeal, that 250 and 260, in the wake of the minimum wage amendment, are now left with very, very little to do under the law. If they are not impliedly repealed, they are essentially moribund and defunct, and they certainly don't apply to the claims of the plaintiffs here. And I can go through the analysis. Right, there are aspects of 250, for example, under 250, the labor commissioner shall, in accordance with federal law, establish by regulation the minimum wage which may be paid, etc. The labor commissioner doesn't do that anymore under the minimum wage amendment. The labor commissioner sets those rates under the minimum wage amendment. The labor commissioner shall prescribe increases in the minimum wage in accordance with those prescribed by federal law. The labor commissioner doesn't do that anymore. Those increases are prescribed by the minimum wage amendment. There is a hook in the minimum wage amendment to capture increases in the federal wage. It is not as straightforward as in 250. And finally, unless the Labor Commissioner determines that those increases are contrary to the public interest. There was a discretion within 250 for the Labor Commissioner to basically negate raises in the minimum wage. That discretion no longer exists. So 250 sub 1 is more or less emptied out. 250 sub 2, which is the exceptions, that was more or less done away with by this court's decision in Thomas. Those exceptions no longer apply. And then 3 involves that it's unlawful to contract for below the minimum wage. That arguably may survive, but there's a provision in the minimum wage that says you cannot, by agreement with an employee, waive the provisions of the minimum wage amendment. There is, in fact, nothing left of 250. And this is important here because 250 is the statute to which 608-260 points for the previous right of action and the consequent 2-year statute of limitations. If 250 more or less doesn't exist, much less, isn't what plaintiffs here made their claims pursuant to, 260 is not the appropriate statute to be looking for an application of the statute of limitations. Not even to mention the fact that the minimum wage amendment's coverage, its remedies, they far exceed that those which were laid out in 608-260. 608-260 said, if under 250 you're paid less than the Labor Commissioner announces you should be paid by regulation, you can bring an action within 2 years for back pay. The minimum wage amendment, however, goes far beyond that. Right? Not only does the Labor Commissioner no longer do that which 250 prescribes, but it now provides for remedies in the form of back pay, damages, injunctive relief, reinstatement, and all other remedies at law or in equity appropriate, available and appropriate, to remedy a violation of this section. That's an unlimited set of possible remedies, whereas 260 limits it directly to back pay within 2 years. Now, if this court agrees that the minimum wage claims arise under the minimum wage amendment because of their very nature, it's left with basically two choices. Because the minimum wage amendment contains an express right of action to enforce its terms, but it does not itself include an express statute of limitations. So that leaves us with two interpretive possibilities. One is that there's no statute of limitations. That bumps up against sort of basic presumption at law that civil claims should have limitations. We understand that. I don't think it's completely out of the realm of possibility. In fact, there's a long line of Illinois cases in which a minimum wage provision there did not have a statute of limitations. And the courts there have said, this is a remedial provision. There are a few things in employment law more important than the lowest paid workers in the state getting more wages. So we're not going to apply a statute of limitations. So it's not impossible. It depends on how this court feels about the basic presumption that, in fact, civil claims ought to have limitations. That is, in fact, why we have NRS 11-220, to codify that particular presumption. And so if the court doesn't agree that there's no statute of limitations under the minimum wage, it ought to revert to 11-220, as this would be an action for relief not herein before provided for. The nature of the claim brings it under that provision rather than any other. And it really can be that simple, because I think every other way in which the district court or claim jumper or any of the other defendants in the myriad cases that have now arisen under this provision, every other version of their interpretation is some version of borrowing. We don't find a statute of limitations in the minimum wage amendment, so we have to borrow it from somewhere else. So let's go through briefly the sort of borrowing aspects of the various...
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And it's a very simple question. Our determination here doesn't take care of all the claims, and it strikes me as somewhat of an advisory opinion that we would be issuing in this case. And that's disturbing to me.
Well, that was raised below, and the district court, we had a lengthy colloquy about that. What the district court, I think, settled on for that was that this is going to be a necessary question for a lot of aspects within this case. And this also goes to the propriety of writ relief at all at the moment, which is when we first filed this case, there were a handful, 2 or 3 of these cases. By my count now, there's upwards of 24 cases arising under the minimum wage amendment that are more or less identical with this case. Because of the particular nature of the minimum wage amendment, wages to a large group of employees, health insurance provided or offered to all those employees, they lend themselves to class action treatment. In the class action context, parties and courts have to be able to settle upon appropriate class definitions. In the event of class certification, notice would have to go
out. Wouldn't that happen in just about every class certification then?
Certainly.
There's always going to be issues that you want to have resolved before you entertain an entire class action, go through the expense and work of putting on your class action, in which case we would be constantly dealing with writs in these class action cases.
And unfortunately, from my reading of your docket, you are, in fact, constantly dealing with this writ. I absolutely understand that. In this particular instance, given the number of these cases, their particular procedural settings, I believe it has now risen to the level of an important statewide question. It is merely a question of law. There are no facts involved here.
But I want to follow up on what my colleague has just asked you about. It seems to me this case procedurally is peculiar. There was a complaint filed. Almost immediately thereafter, there is something called a motion for summary judgment filed by you. But you are not seeking to preclude any claim. Rather, you're kind of seeking deck relief as to how far back your claims are going to run.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the office of Rule 56 as written. I could see maybe it comes up in the class certification context. But it is troubling. I do share Justice Perry's concern that, however useful it might be, we don't have a Massachusetts advisory opinion mechanism here in Nevada, except for NRAP 5. And there's some NRAP 5 cases on this headed our way. But it's worrisome to me. So tell me why procedurally your motion for summary judgment was appropriate under the rule and why its denial is properly before us here.
I mean,
or if it was denied. I don't know whether it was granted or denied. I can't tell.
It was determined. Let's call it that. The district court determined a 2-year statute of limitations. And the district court did discuss this at the hearing and thought that perhaps that this was in the nature of an advisory opinion. Given its setting within the litigation, the court thought it prudent to proceed. Now, I think there's a way to characterize our motion in a way that would cure that issue, which is defendants made, for example, an affirmative defense regarding the statute of limitations. I mean, this would be in the nature of a motion to strike the affirmative defense for the exact same reasons. Now, the NRAP cases...
But that wasn't what you brought.
Correct. That's correct. Now, there is another writ on exactly the same question that is just behind this, and it's on a defense motion to throw out claims prior to the 2 years. So, in essence... This is coming anyway, one way or the other. There have been defense motions. There have been plaintiff's motions.
They're slouching their way to Carson City.
Yes, exactly right, Yates. The NRAP cases are on a slightly different issue, but you may see that as well. Right. I have reserved a few moments of my time, if that's
okay. Appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Schreier. Morning, counsel.
Morning. I'm Elena Huchaw. I'm here on behalf of the Real Party and Interest Claim Jumper, and I thank you for your time this morning. I think there are 5 interrelated reasons why Section 16 of Article 15 of the Nevada Constitution, which we refer to as the Minimum Wage Amendment, is properly interpreted to include the 2-year statute of limitations that was established in 1965 by NRS 608-260. This court has for 100 years stated that when at all possible, provisions that come after an existing provision should be harmonized when they are similar in content and in message. And that was first established in Presson v. Presson in 1915 and most recently stated much more succinctly perhaps in Thomas v. Yellow Cab. In Presson, however, the court made a very important statement, and that statement was that whenever two acts can be made to stand together, it is the duty of the judge to give them both effect. Even when they are seemingly repugnant, they must, if possible, have such a construction that one may not be a repeal of the other unless the latter, which here, of course, would be the minimum wage amendment, contains negative words or the intention is manifest by some intelligible form of expression. As is simply stated in Yellow Cab, of course, the exception to harmonization arises when there are irreconcilable repugnancy or the two provisions cannot logically coexist. NRS 608-260 is neither repugnant to nor can it illogically not coexist if you allow the double negative with the minimum wage amendment. Unlike Yellow Cab, the minimum wage amendment does not contain a express statement as to statute of limitations that must now be reconciled with an existing statute. That makes this case distinct from the analysis applied in Yellow Cab, where the existence of one thing is the preclusion of the other. That does not exist here. Here we have a minimum wage amendment that expressly states its intent is to incorporate all remedies available and appropriate in law and equity, and then provides a list of remedies that includes, but is not limited to, the language of the minimum wage amendment itself, those stated in the minimum wage amendment. This language extends itself to the incorporation of an existing statutory scheme, the NRS 608-250, 260, 270, and 290. If the minimum wage amendment is read such that the intent was to replace, perhaps, supplant, whatever word is best used here, this statutory scheme, what it will affect is it will rob the labor commissioner of his ability to issue penalties under 270 and 290 to seek criminal prosecution, and to take those acts that for many, many, many years the labor commissioner has done to protect the employees of the state of Nevada, that is, to ensure they are paid minimum wage, whatever that minimum wage is as established by the state. And because 260 refers to NRS 250, 270 refers to NRS 250, and 608-290 refers to NRS 250, it simply cannot be that, as the petitioner contends, that these statutes are rendered a nullity. In other words, they no longer have any real effect, although they are not repealed. That would not be consistent with Nevada law, since Nevada law, as is consistent across the country, statutory language is to be given its fullest potential effect, and no word or provision is to be rendered a nullity just because another statute comes along. And the language of the minimum wage amendment clearly allows for the incorporation of NRS 260, and consistent with this court's decision in Landreth and in White Pine, borrowing the most on-point statute of limitations, harmonizing the minimum wage amendment with the statute of limitations that has existed for 50 years is appropriate in this case. Although the notion that no statute of limitations could apply simply does not make sense. There are evidentiary reasons not to allow a civil claim to exist without a statute of limitations. An indefinite period of time keeps a defendant without the ability to know the potential liability it may suffer. It encourages, of course, no statute of limitations would allow a plaintiff to sleep on their rights. And that was all established by the court in 1985 as the reasons why the court disfavors no statute of limitations in civil cases. But if we look again at NRS 260 and we look at the language of the minimum wage amendment, the minimum wage amendment says expressly at the end that an employee may, is the language, when speaking of an individual's rights, bring an action to the court in order to right the wrongs that have occurred under the minimum wage amendment. If this is read to allow claims to continue to be brought to the labor commissioner, so that the labor commissioner, as the court decided in Baldonado, can act in accordance with its authority in the state, then we must look beyond NRS 608-260 and note that at NAC 607-105, the labor commissioner, like NRS 608-260, has established a 2-year statute of limitations for bringing a claim to that office. That the language in NAC is 24 months, but I think the math is easily done to say that's 2 years, which is consistent with the NRS. If this court were to adopt the catch-all, but allow and find that the Labor Commissioner's ability to enforce the minimum wage amendment has not been repealed, we would have two different statute of limitations. You would have a statute of limitations applicable to a claim brought to a court, the catch-all of 4 years, whereas the Labor Commissioner would have a 2-year statute of limitations. That would be an absurd result. Another basis that the court has found to deny the interpretation of a statute or a provision as stated here by the petitioners. The third statute on point, which is noted in our briefs, is NRS 608-115, which requires the retention of payroll records for 2 years in the state of Nevada. So we have this long precedent and a statutory scheme consistent with the 2-year statute of limitations. We have a minimum wage amendment that incorporates available remedies, which is a 2-year statute of limitations, and there is no reason that these provisions are either repugnant, irreconcilable, nor can they illogically not coexist. There is simply no language that prevents that. With respect to implied repeal, again, obviously in Terry, the court found that 250 and 260 were still viable statutes under which an employee could bring a claim. If the Terry decision is to be given effect, it certainly, among other things, confirms the fact that these statutes have not been repealed. And the analysis of 250 and 260 can be made, as Presson suggests, to, even though on their face may seem to have some irreconcilability, can be made to be read to reconcile the minimum wage amendment. 260 clearly says you have a 2-year statute of limitations to bring a claim as established in NRS 250 pursuant to the regulations promulgated by the Labor Commissioner. Assuming the Labor Commissioner has a constitutional authority or executive authority to promulgate regulations, the Labor Commissioner has done so, and NAC 608-100 has adopted an express methodology for enforcing the minimum wage amendment that is consistent with the language in the first sentence of NRS 608-250. In other words, you can read 260 to incorporate the first sentence of the first section of NRS 608-250, take yourself to the Nevada Administrative Code promulgated by our Labor Commissioner at NAC 608-100, and you have a statutory scheme enforced by regulation consistent with the language of the statutes that is also consistent with the minimum wage amendment. There's nothing repugnant or irreconcilable about that. In addition,
Council, could I interrupt you? In the time's running, and I want to make sure we address the question that has been proffered by Justice Perigary and Justice Pickering. Should the court entertain this writ in light of the procedural posture below, and was the district court's order advisory?
Your Honor, the real party in interest certainly did not agree and does not agree today that a summary judgment was the appropriate methodology for bringing the claim or seeking the relief that the petitioners sought. That could have been sought through a motion on the pleadings or to strike, as the court has mentioned, an affirmative defense. And there was certainly no issue of fact before the court that would lead the court to a Rule 56 motion. Since the filing of the petitions, there have been so many cases and filed under the minimum wage amendment that affect employers as well as employees in the state. And there are now disparate decisions. There are decisions that have applied a variety of statute of limitations. And for this reason, I think the public policy behind a writ would allow the court or...
So you would maintain that under our jurisprudence, where there are disparate treatment... by district courts of this issue, we should entertain it for that reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
So may I follow up on that and ask what relief was granted below?
There was a 2-year statute of limitations.
They only established that. I read it. It's a 13-page decision. Okay, so in your mind, the motion obviously was denied, period.
Correct.
With a bunch of writing.
Correct. With an analysis that led the court to that ruling, yes.
But, so you would say then, to the extent there's a plaintiff whose employment went back 4 years, that plaintiff's claim is now limited to 2 years?
Correct. In our case, Your
Honor. Even though you did not seek that relief, you were not the moving party below. Rather, it was the plaintiff.
That's correct, Your Honor. Sometimes plaintiffs make motions that they lose. And
it's really in the nature of a motion in limine almost.
It is, Your Honor. And we are
And how do we know, I mean, I know from our docket and that there are other cases presenting this issue, but how do we know what they are to the extent they're not on our docket? And this case had the anomaly that I believe somebody tried to supplement the record with orders entered in other cases that were either in conflict or supporting one side or the other, and those were stricken. Is that right?
That's correct.
So beyond that, we don't know in the universe of this case how to validate your statement that there are conflicting orders, and if so, what they are.
Correct, Your Honor. It's only that there is another writ that has been sought
before the
court. Correct. And there's also, I'm sorry, the taxi cab case, Western Cab,
okay,
that I believe. So there are several cases. But in the context of this case, there is nothing to indicate that there has been inconsistent or different decisions by the 8th Judicial.
Well, we can look at our own docket and identify this based on the cases you've just mentioned.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
We can look at our own docket and verify that fact just on the basis of the two cases you mentioned.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there was an attempt to consolidate this case with another case pending before the court.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those.
And then amicus filings as well, right?
Yes, okay. Yes. I'll conclude my statements with the minute and a half I have left that, again, that NRS 608-260 was enacted with a 2-year statute of limitations 50 years ago. In Strickland v. Waymire, that this court decided, the court made a statement that I think is applicable here, that where an act purports to overturn longstanding precedent and completely change a statutory scheme, it is not too much to ask that this be done in unmistakable language. That has not been done by the Minimum Wage Amendment. There is no unmistakable language in the Minimum Wage Amendment or in the ballot initiative that indicates an intent to repeal or replace a statutory scheme established 100 years ago by Presson v. Presson, where at all possible the courts are asked to reconcile statutes and constitutional amendments such that they can be read together rather than one can be found to repeal another. Here the language signaling the inclusion of all remedies available and appropriate suggests very heavily an incorporation of an existing statutory scheme rather than a repeal or a rendering of a nullity, that statutory scheme, which would include, if read appropriately, the repeal of 2000, I'm sorry, of...
Go ahead, finish your argument.
Thank you, of NRS 608-250, which would then render a nullity 270 and 290 and rob the Labor Commissioner of the authority to enforce minimum wage in the state of Nevada. Thank
you. Thank you. Mr. Schrader.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll make some very, very quick points. Number one, this notion that the all remedies available and appropriate in the Minimum Wage Amendment serves to embrace 250 and 260. Let's be very clear that a statute of limitations is not a remedy. It is a temporal boundary upon liability. It is a period within which you may recover your remedies. It is not itself a remedy. So the all remedies language doesn't point to a statute of limitations. It is not a grounds for borrowing. And I want to go back to White Pine and its progeny in Alper. Those were not borrowing cases. Those were characterization cases. This court was characterizing the claim and then finding the appropriate statute of limitation in statute. Borrowing is a particularly federal jurisprudential concept, and it arose because under federal law, when Congress didn't have a statute of limitations, there was no federal catch-all. That was remedied in 1990 because federal judges said we're spending too much time looking for analogous state law claims, and there's a patchwork of analysis, and it's not appropriate anyway. So in 1990, Congress passed 28 U.S.C. 1658 that established the catch-all, the catch-all that we've had for well over 100 years. I think it was 1911. Now, this notion that the minimum wage amendment is just an extension, sort of super statute, that flies in the face of the fact that we're dealing with the state constitution.
What I appreciate that point, but what do you make of your opposing counsel's argument that this would, granting credit in your argument, would create an anomaly that the labor commissioner's power would be 2 years, limited to 2 years, whereas an individual plaintiff's would be four, and the whole statutory scheme would be
unsettled.
Unbalanced. Yeah.
Well, to the labor commissioner's point, the labor commissioner's job is not to interpret and enforce the Constitution as she sees it. It's to enforce it as it is, and as this court says it is. From a regulatory standpoint, the regulation that carries the 24-month term, that ought to be altered in the wake of a differing decision by this court. And in fact, two of the Labor Commissioner's administrative regulations implementing the minimum wage amendment were in August struck down by Judge Wilson in Carson City because they didn't comport with and they exceeded her authority. So there are mechanisms by which the Labor Commissioner should do faithful duty to the amendment rather than vice versa. May I finish one quick point, Your Honor?
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. You know, this notion of arising under, I'm still not entirely sure what it means for a constitutional provision to arise under a statute. And that comes in the district court's order. It comes in the claim jumper's brief as well. Constitutional provisions and their violation when there's express rights of action don't arise under anything but themselves. Right? It seems to be a stand-in for please don't look here, look over there. Borrow it from over here. Seems to me that if we're going to look for a statute of limitations outside of the minimum wage amendment itself, the very reason we have the catch-all is for circumstances just like this. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schrager. Ms. Chow, thank you very much for your argument, and the matter will stand submitted.